Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Adam Bobek, and I'm a PhD candidate in sociocultural anthropology at the University of Leipzig. I am super excited to welcome Dr. Aubrey Taman and Dr. Calliope M. Christodoulaki to the program today to discuss their new book, Beyond the Veil, Reflexive Studies in Death and Dying, published in 2021 with Berghahn. Aubrey Taman is an American studies scholar and anthropologist, and she has begun research into the fields of fat studies and food studies, specifically exploring where these fields intersect. Calliope M. Christodoulaki is a cultural anthropologist and independent researcher, currently working as a limited-term lecturer at Purdue University, and her research interests include religious practices, social identity, and cultural change. Dr. Taman, Dr. Christodoulaki, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yes, wonderful to be here.
What inspired you to put this book together?
Well, that's kind of a long story. So as we mentioned in the introduction of the book, Calliope and I were classmates at Purdue. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Calliope, you started before I did, right?
Yes.
I started in 2003.
Mm-hmm. 2002 for me.
Okay. And we were both, now, of course, I was not working on this at that time, but over the years, we sort of both discovered that we were both researching death. We both had interests in death as an academic subject. And I don't even think we had necessarily talked about collaborating until the memorial service of a beloved professor, O.M. Watson. He was emeritus at the time that he passed away from esophageal cancer. And they threw this, and this was just perfect for him. They threw a huge party, and we were celebrating his life together, you know, a bunch of his students, his daughters, friends, colleagues. And we were both talking about things that we were writing about at the time. And I mentioned offhand that I thought we should collaborate. And then, of course, life gets in the way, and nothing really came of that at that time. But in 2017, I was teaching at Wittenberg College in Springfield, Ohio, and they asked me to give a talk about my research at their fall colloquium for the sociology department. And I was so excited with sort of how I had narrowed down my dissertation into this sort of brief essay and presentation. And I really liked what I had done with it. And so I remembered that Calliope and I, had talked about collaborating. And so I reached out to her and I said, hey, do you remember all those years ago when I said we should get together? And she was like, okay, let's do it. So that sort of started the process of putting out the call for papers, narrowing that down, and then, you know, the all of the process that comes with putting a book together.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have nothing to add. That's exactly how it happened. And it was wonderful having someone follow through with a suggestion like that, because sometimes that doesn't happen. So.
And why is it so important to have reflexive studies of death and dying?
So for me, that is just the way that I write. So I, the reason why I went to American studies in particular and not anthropology in the first place, was because I was very interested in my own culture. So sort of, getting into it rather than just sort of being a member that doesn't ever think about, you know, any of the processes behind why we do the things we do. So I wanted to get at that. So I was, that's why I ended up in American studies as a field. But of course, because I'm interested in culture, that's why I chose the disc, because American studies is interdisciplinary. So most American studies scholars are either historians or literary scholars. Very few of us are anthropologists, but to me, it just made sense because they both look at cultural studies. And so that is, you know, really what I wanted to focus on. And when I was in school, so when I was still taking classes, still interested in looking at folklore, actually, I took a class and read Renato Rosaldo's book. I was like blown away by just the way he talked about his experiences in the field, and was like, that is what I want to do. So he was very reflexive. He is a postmodernist. And so postmodernism in general, although not necessarily in vogue anymore, is just reflexive by nature, you know, sort of looking at the biases that we bring in as members of a culture when we observe others. And so I just wanted to, it was important to me to sort of stick to that, you know, acknowledging that in cultural analysis, anything I say is always going to be colored by my own experiences as a white cishet woman in, you know, Gen X growing up in the US at a specific time and place. So it was just important to me as a scholar to maintain that sort of conscious connection with my own observational biases, I guess.
Yes, and I find it an honest way of discussing the work that we do, right? Because you kind of lay out your connections to the research you're doing and how that shapes your thoughts about what you're studying. So I also studied a culture that I had been exposed to since my childhood. And so I wanted to make sure that people were aware that those connections existed and how that might impact my view on the society and the questions I was asking. And I think that's good practice for everyone who's doing any kind of research to kind of step back and think about their work critically and how they influence the research questions they're asking and their analysis of the data that they're, you know, looking at.
And so what sort of audience did you have in mind for a book like this?
I personally was interested in getting it out there to as broad of an audience as possible. We wanted to make it useful in an academic setting. You know, there are plenty of classes that look at death and dying across disciplines. And so we wanted it to be useful in those contexts, but we also wanted it to be accessible to anyone who might be questioning the processes behind how they grieve, why they're grieving in a particular way, social connections that are either made or lost in the context of death. And so we kind of wanted to have as broad an audience as possible.
So you divide the book into four sections. Could you give listeners maybe a little bit of an overview of each section?
Do you want to talk about the first section, Aubrey?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I can do that. So we, you know, it was sort of organic, I guess, because we put out our call for papers. You know, we got a lot. We had a lot of submissions. And so we wanted to make sure that we really selected authors. We didn't even have a number in mind. We basically wanted to find the essays that would fit with what we were trying to do. So we wanted to make sure that there was a genuine attempt at reflexivity. And then also, you know, that it was focused, of course, on death in some way. And so we noticed themes, essentially, when we finally narrowed it down to the, 11 essays that we included in the book. And we just noticed themes. And that was actually all Calliope who, you know, sort of pointed out these themes and said, why don't we kind of break them down into these sections? And then, of course, the order there sort of makes sense in a way. You know, there's sort of before death, during death, and then after. But in terms of delaying death, and this is something that I wrote about in my dissertation. I don't think I mentioned it very much in this essay, but in my dissertation in particular, I talked about how, you know, of course, most cultures have some fear of death, even if it's something that is accepted as an everyday occurrence. We don't want to die, right? And so in the US, though, there is this sort of almost pathological fear where we want to deny it as much as possible. And so the two essays in part one talk about drastic measures that people take to try to delay death as much as possible. So with Allison, you know, she talks about people having genetic testing and finding out that they have the markers for breast and ovarian cancer and doing preemptive mastectomies and preemptive hysterectomies in order to, you know, people who have not been diagnosed, but maybe who have a family history of it, might as well get rid of the offending body parts ahead of time, you know, to sort of prevent the possibility that this genetic mutation might take effect, right? And then Jeremy's work, which I thought was pretty interesting. He works with, I forget the acronym, what it stands for, but the RADFest, the folks who basically believe that there is a way to prevent death entirely. And they look at death as a failure. So people sort of either not doing whatever it is they're supposed to do right, or people giving up, essentially. And so, and of course his work is in Canada, and but I think it's sort of a Western idea at this point where, you know, we kind of want to do whatever we can to kind of prevent death. So that was the first section. And of course, the next one has Calliope's essay in it.
Yeah. So for caregiving, I mean, there is a segment of the population where they go through an end of life phase and might require assistance. And that assistance is caregiving, which both Karina Nanvel and I experience and write about in our essays. And caregiving is an interesting experience in that it's very isolating, both for the person who's going through that stage in their life and also for the caregivers. Oftentimes people don't like to be around people who are in the process of dying. And so you find yourself alone, and both as a caregiver and as the individual who is dying. And so it's an emotionally and physically draining experience. There's been studies that show that the kind of the stress of it makes wounds heal less quickly, and people have kind of medical issues that come up from the stress, but it can also be a rewarding experience. And so for me, for 6 months, I helped care for my grandmother. I felt, you know, I helped kind of deal with her loss, and I was able to learn about dying and death and to see it happen and to discuss it with people who did come to visit, and also to watch her kind of slowly letting go. So I got to see the process firsthand, and it was transformative. It was a learning experience. Karina Nandlo also writes about how it was a transformative experience for her. She cared for her mother, who has Alzheimer's, I believe. And she found it gratifying as well. And so even in all that darkness, all that, you know, physical exertion, emotional kind of trauma that's happening, you can also find aspects of it that are important for the person who's dying and also for the person who's, you know, there giving care to that person. So that section is really about kind of letting go and finding what is rewarding in those experiences. And then we move on to confronting death, which has Aubrey's chapter along with two others in there.
Yeah. So, death is obviously inevitable, and it happens. And, you know, something that I mention in the essay is that I suffered a lot of loss during grad school, and that definitely shaped not only my studies, but also how I process death. I mean, I went through a phase where I was so terrified that, you know, who's next, basically. You know, I ended up, you know, going through this sort of bout of OCD with my husband and having this goodbye ritual that I had to say exactly the right way, or else, you know, how would I feel if something happened to him? And, you know, it got to the point where if I left and forgot something, I'd have to go back and make sure that I said all of the things that I needed to say. And so it was sort of this interesting process of starting out, you know, it was something that had always happened. And I think the turning point was the death of my cousin, the suicide of my cousin. Because up until that point, everyone I had lost was older, you know, my grandfather, great aunts and uncles. And then I did lose an uncle, but he was not in the best of health. And so it was sad and heartbreaking. But the death of my cousin was really this turning point for me of, like, you know, people my age die. And so I, you know, kind of had to deal with all of that. And then sort of moving through that, getting away from that, being able to heal and let go of those compulsive behaviors with saying goodbye to loved ones, my husband in particular, and then coming out in the end where in the revision process of my dissertation, I lost two aunts and my grandmother. And all three of those deaths were a mercy. One of whom had cancer, one of whom was severely depressed, and then my grandmother had dementia for quite some time. And so it was sort of this, it was kind of this sort of perfect parallel of finally being able to not only complete my work, but then also to be able to let go of some of that fear that I had of death. And so I didn't set out for it to be this cathartic experience writing all of this, but it ended up being that, I guess. And I think for Eckhart in particular, he was working as a funeral director. He decided for his work that in order to be sort of the best participant observer, that it would benefit him to just become a funeral director. So he got involved in that field and was able to sort of experience it from that firsthand experience. So I liked being able to put our essays together because I was sort of talking about funeral directors from an outside perspective and he was talking about them from an inside perspective. So I really liked being able to have that juxtaposition. And then the final essay in the section, in that particular section by Sarah Nitro, she did a lot of family history. She did a lot of interviews and oral history with her family and the way that her family in particular dealt with death and dying. And she talks specifically about Catholic ritual. And I found that really interesting again. And of course, this is, I guess, me being sort of heavily focused on self. So I apologize for that. But also, having been raised Catholic, when I presented my research, I had a friend of mine who is a professor at a neighboring school come over and sit through my presentation at Wittenberg. And she was also raised Catholic, and she made the comment. She was like, "Holy crap, I had no idea how Catholic your work is." And it wasn't something that I had intended to do, but almost all of the funerals that I had been to were Catholic funerals. And they have very specific rituals because Catholics require a funeral mass. So it's a lot more involved than, I think, Protestant funerals, in the sense that there's this hour and a half long actual mass that people go through. And then there's also the wake. And then there's also the graveside service. So it's this really complicated, either very long day, or sometimes it's split into 2 days, depending on, you know, the family, what they do. So, I think it was interesting for her, because if memory serves, I think she's younger than Calliope and I are. So she hadn't really faced a lot of personal death until, you know, she started recording these histories of her family. And that's when she started really connecting with, the sense or the experience of familial loss. And so just having like all of these essays confronting death in different ways, you know, someone who had sort of been enmeshed in it, someone who came at it from the professional side, someone who hadn't experienced it very much, but oh my gosh, death is a thing that happens. It was kind of interesting, I think, having those 3 essays together.
Mm-hmm. And the final part 4 was memorialization, which does happen in some cultures where it's important to memorialize the person who's passed away. And we have a public figure, Harmon Killebrew, and his memorialization by fans, and including the researcher Debbie A. Hansen, Olivia Gunteric, and Claudia Bilotti. They wrote about memorialization on the internet and kind of the good and bad aspects of it. Rebecca Moore wrote about memorializing the Jonestown dead and looked at questions of insider and outsider and how people believe that one group was allowed to memorialize the dead while the others shouldn't. And the final essay was Cammie Fletcher's, which looked at memorialization using rest in peace t-shirts among African Americans, and, you know, as a way to tell individuals a little bit about to tell them about the person who'd passed away, and also to kind of mark their connection to that person. And so we did have these 4 essays that talk about memorializations. We didn't have any essays about the kind of cultures that don't memorialize the dead, that, you know, decide to, you know, have their, they don't, they destroy or give away all their belongings, and they are not meant to mention the person who's died. That would have been an interesting aspect, but we had no one to offer that kind of essay. So instead we focus on memorialization. And that's also a big part of what happened in my own research. It's very important to continually memorialize the dead as well. And that kind of finishes up our sections in the book.
Speaking of your own research, Dr. Krista Dulacki, could you maybe get into your chapter a little bit and talk about the connections between death and identity?
Sure. I mean, my research began with my master's thesis, and I went to study death and dying in this Greek village on the island of Karpathos over the span of a summer. And I write in my chapter how no one passed away that summer. Instead, I went to a lot of memorial services. And the one thing I noticed during that master's thesis research was that it really seemed to me to keep the community together, and the community was really interested in maintaining those ties. And one way they did that was through these memorialization services. But I also, when I went back later to do my dissertation research, which was on a different topic altogether, I did experience death 3 days, I think, after I arrived. One of the women that visited me the day I arrived passed away. And so I saw a funeral at that point and saw people kind of go through the steps of the funeral. And so it became clear to me that in these instances that rituals sustain those social connections and kind of also show one's role in the society. And also there is a presentation of self, as Goffman says, in these kind of events where you are considering what others think of you in some way. But there's also an internal aspect associated with feelings, and those feelings can be of sadness, of grief, of guilt, of wanting to honor the dead. And all this is kind of going through, you know, when I was experiencing specifically the loss of my grandmother, those feelings were going, you know, those were things I was considering. And so I found the rituals to be helpful in that they guided me through the process, this really kind of where you kind of feel unmoored kind of, and you have all these emotions. People knew how to help me because they kind of helped me follow the rituals, the various rituals that I needed to do. But it was also these rituals allowed me to kind of showcase who my grandmother was and who I was as well. So if I did the rituals correct, or, and I can even step back, if I provided the appropriate amount of care for my grandmother, that made me a good granddaughter, and that was important in the eyes of the community. I mean, I have had access to the community, and I've heard stories of bad daughters, bad grandmothers, bad husbands, and so forth. And so there was an expectation already. I understood those expectations of what it meant to be a good family member, but also a good person, a good community member. And so I tried to fulfill those roles as much as I could. And it began with giving her care. So there was that aspect that I want to show that I'm doing what I need to do for my grandmother because I'm a good person, I'm a good granddaughter. But then you really did want it. I mean, I really did want to do it because I had this connection with her that was an emotional connection, a connection based on history and experiences. And so that was all very important. And the kind of the funeral itself was a way to really showcase who my grandmother was to the family, to myself, and to the community. And so people in this community made sure that they, that the funerals were well planned, the memorial services were well planned, because it showed an indication of prestige in the community, and also a way of honoring the deceased, right? So, you know, if you didn't put together a good funeral or a good memorial service, that means this person wasn't cared for and you didn't honor them in the way that they should. And that would also reflect on you negatively, especially if they felt that the person was somebody who should be honored and should be respected. And so the funeral, the memorial services were all kind of a way to showcase that I was a good person, I was a good Carpathian, I was a good Eastern Orthodox Christian, I was a good granddaughter, and all of that. And while also kind of letting people know that, my grandmother was somebody worthy of being respected and mourned, and so forth. And you see these questions of identity also in Rebecca Moore's research on Jonestown Memorial with the insider-outsider, and Cammie Fletcher's work as well, with identifying the deceased as important through kind of their memorialization that occurs. And so you just let people know where the deceased stands, where others in attendance stand, where you stand. And some of it is calculated and performed, but a lot of it is also felt deeply in terms of obligation, duty, honor, sadness, grief, whatever emotions the person's feeling. And more recently, you kind of got to see the importance of identity and funeral in Queen Elizabeth's funeral. If you watched the procession, you saw where relatives were in the procession and if they were allowed to wear a military uniform or they weren't allowed to wear a military uniform. And the whole mourning ritual, mourning period in the UK, you know, that was set aside to kind of reinforce how important Queen Elizabeth was to the entire country in various different ways. So, yeah, that was my chapter.
One thing that jumped out at me in your chapter was the role that gender was sort of playing throughout these different rituals. Could you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So traditionally in Greek culture, and even if you read ancient Greek accounts, women are the ones that caregive, and they're the ones especially present during kind of funerals and memorial services. And they have the important role of taking care of the person who's dying and the person who has passed away, whose body needs to be prepared for death. Without that preparation, they kind of are seen as not doing their final duty to the deceased, whoever that might be, usually a close relative or a spouse or something. And also it's problematic for the person who's died because the soul kind of needs assistance from the living to get where they are going. And so women have this kind of caregiving role that continues well after the death. So there's a fragile border and you continue to have church services and memorial services for the individual. And the idea is that you kind of move their soul along and help them in the afterlife. Men are also present, but they're kind of removed a little bit. So when someone passes away, you know, and this was in 2005, things have changed quite drastically in the village and in the island. But at that time, when somebody passed away, they're laid out in the home and the women stay near the body, but the men stay in a room adjoining the body and they spend the entire night until the next day when the funeral happens and the body's buried. There are some roles for men, such as carrying the casket. And one that was very important and made a kind of a real impact on me was long ago, my great-grandmother died, and I remember that my grandfather wanted to hold the lid of her casket, which is the person who leads the procession to the church. And I remember seeing him, because I did not go to the funeral, I watched it, and I remember him holding the lid of the casket and leading the funeral and just remembering his face. And then many years later, when my grandmother had died, one of my cousins requested to have that position. He wanted to hold the lid of the casket for my grandmother to lead the procession. And so these kinds of things are important, and they are gendered in that, you know, men are expected to deal with the casket, ordering the casket, bringing the casket up, transporting the body, but the women are meant to kind of prepare the body and then organize the rituals that happen afterward.
And speaking of ritual, Dr. Taman's chapter deals quite a bit with this idea of the connections between death and ritual. Dr. Taman, can you get into that?
Yeah. So I focus largely on sort of rituals that I saw continuing to come out, not only with mourners, but also with the funeral directors themselves. One of the things that I found particularly fascinating when I was doing my field work was the first time I observed an embalming. And I could definitely, I mean, the ritual process of it for the embalmer just jumped out at me. You know, he it was very interesting that he not only compartmentalized the body, so he went through the various stages of embalming very precisely. You know, first they have to clean the body, then they have to, you know, make the cut in the neck to pull out the vein and artery, because one will drain blood, one will have your embalming fluid enter in. So just that process, and then also putting the body, because embalming fluid, it doesn't harden the body, but it stiffens the body. And so he would, you know, place the hands where the hands needed to go, make sure that one of the tricks they do is they will put cotton behind the ears to make the ears sort of stick out a little bit more, and just various things. So he sort of went part by part, but then also talked to the decedent, you know, Mr. So-and-so, this is what we're going to do first. This is what we're going to do next. And it was really important to him, clearly important to him, to maintain the personification at the same time that he was compartmentalizing, right? So, and one of the things that particular funeral director said to me in an interview was that for him, from his perspective, when the hardest deaths were that of teenagers and children. But outside of that, you either looked at it, if you were a religious person, for example, you believed that the soul had moved on and it was just a body left behind. But if you did not have a faith system, so if you're an atheist or agnostic, whatever, it's still just a shell. So he kind of talked about being able to kind of separate that. But it was still very important to maintain the fact that this was a person, that this was someone who had been loved, this was someone who had been cared for, this was someone who was important to someone, at least one person in their lifetime. And so I thought that was really interesting, that it wasn't just about the rituals that we go through as mourners. So, you know, there's, for example, the, so there's the sort of secular side rituals, in other words, contacting the funeral director, making sure that you contact a florist if you're going to have flowers. Then there's sort of the nuts and bolts stuff, talking to the life insurance folks, talking to, you know, the doctor if there's some issue with the death certificate. There's all of these sort of aspects of it, right? And then the funeral in particular, you know, making sure that you make those phone calls, making sure that you pick out music if that's something that you want. So there's sort of all of these aspects to it as a mourner, as the bereaved, but then also behind the scenes, there's also a lot of ritual aspect to it. You know, just this process of getting things set up, the embalming process, as I mentioned, they all have sort of steps that they will do things in order of, you know, in terms of like when to contact the paper and put out the obituary and things like that. So I just, and again, this might just be me being an anthropologist, but I just saw ritual everywhere. And so it was hard for me not to write about it, because in everything that was done, both on the bereaved side and then on the behind the scenes side, I just saw it everywhere. And so it was, it just sort of was something that jumped out at me. So it was something that I focused on, because personally, I don't see a way to separate the way that we deal with death and dying and ritual.
One thing that your chapter really brought into focus for me, who, to be fair, I haven't thought about this a lot before reading this book, was the importance of the role of funeral directors in taking care of people, in taking care of how all of this takes place. Could you maybe talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned earlier, in the West and in the US in particular, we want to do everything we can to avoid talking about death, facing death, dealing with death, et cetera. And so funeral directors have sort of emerged as this really important role, because then they're the ones that get to deal with all of that stuff that we don't want to deal with. They're the ones who clean the body. They're the ones who prepare the body for burial. They're the ones who do hair and makeup. They're the ones who typically will contact the life insurance folks. They're the ones who deal with all of that. And so we are able to just sit in our grief and deal with our grief and our sorrow. And they've sort of become this really important figure in American funerals in particular. And so I sort of talked about how they're also liminal figures. So they spend a lot of time, and that's true in a lot of contexts. So societally speaking, you know, I think, and I heard stories from every funeral director I interviewed where if they, like one of them said, if I'm on a plane and I have a particularly chatty neighbor and I don't want to talk to them, as soon as they ask me what I do, I tell them I'm an embalmer or a mortician and they stop talking. And so, you know, they're sort of liminal societally, right? So we think it's kind of this sort of taboo. They deal with death and dead bodies, and so they're kind of sort of on the margins in that sense. But then at the funeral itself, they intentionally occupy liminal spaces. So they're sort of on the edge. They're sort of behind the scenes so that we're not focused on them, so that we're able to focus on each other. We're able to focus on the decedent. We're able to sort of spend that time, you know, talking about memories, sharing stories, sharing love. And we don't have to worry about any of the nuts and bolts stuff that they take care of. You know, they line up the cars for the procession from the funeral home to, or church, wherever it's being held, to the gravesite. They are the ones who arrange the flowers. They're the ones who, you know, sort of shuffle people in where they need to go. So they do sort of all of these things so that we don't have to worry about it. And we don't even notice that they're there. And in funerals that I went to after I had already sort of written everything and done all of this, I really started to observe, so particularly at my aunt's funeral, kind of just observing what they were doing. And it was really interesting because you do not think about them. When you're at a funeral for someone that you have lost, you don't think about the funeral directors at all. And so I think they really, whether they do it consciously or not, I think they really utilize this liminality, this liminal space that they occupy, to be able to make things go more smoothly. And I do mention that while I don't particularly agree with Durkheim's functionalist approach to bereavement and memorial ritual, I do really like his focus on social cohesion because and I saw this in particular with the death of my cousin, because that sort of really, nobody knew how to deal with it because he had died by suicide. And so there was sort of this massive fracturing of the family. And then to be able to see everybody coming back together for my aunt's funeral, it was at my aunt's funeral that my cousin's wife asked for her wedding ring back, because when he had first died, she was like, you need to take this or I will throw it in the trash, because she was so angry with what he had done. And so to be able to sort of see them reconnecting, and that happened because we didn't have to worry about what we were going to do with my aunt's body, you know, who was going to say the mass, who was going to, you know, get her from point A to point B. We were able to just focus on each other. And I think that that is the central role of the funeral director, particularly in U.S. funerals, which is basically allowing the family, in an event that can break social ties, to allow the family to either come back together or to further cement those social ties and those social connections. And so that was sort of the role that I saw emerge when I did my research, was just that they use their liminality to be able to help foster those connections and help us maintain those connections with each other.
So you bring up Durkheim and functionalism, and this is a beautiful segue into my next question, which is slightly theoretical, but it brings both of your chapters together, and that is this idea of performance. Could you maybe speak about the importance of performance in your studies on death?
Calliope, do you want to go first?
I mean, for mine, it's my chapter, it's central because I in Greek culture, what kept coming up when I was there from the time I was doing master's thesis work was really this sense of, you know, letting people know kind of what's happening. So there was a saying, "Tin ikona pou dichnis pros ta exo," the icon that, or the, you know, the image that you're showing to the outside world. And so how can people know how you're grieving a loss if you aren't showing it in some way? And so, you know, kind of that aspect was very important in funerals. And so there was a performative aspect. I mean, you're supposed to show that you are grieving. And in the past, you know, there was more of a performance in some ways in that it was kind of more extreme than what we would be used to in the United States. On the island of Karpathos, people would, you know, keen near the dead body, or there were examples of women who used to wear their hair braided and under a headscarf, undoing the headscarf, taking out the braids and pulling their hair to show how much the death of this individual, you know, caused them pain. And so, you know, during the funeral, it was important to show how much you respected the person that died and how much they meant to you. And so being emotional was expected. And doing the quote unquote proper things that was required of you as a family member was expected. And so if you didn't do that, then how would you be measured? I mean, how would they know, you know, what to say about your experiences with this individual who's passed away? Now, there's an understanding that there's internal feelings, and sometimes individuals might not act in a way that is expected, and they might explain that as well. For me, the research that I've done, there was an element of performance, and that performance was for others, but also for oneself. I decided to write Miroloya, which are like lamentations in Greek. And I spent a good long time writing these so I could say them at my grandmother's funeral, because I felt if I didn't do that, people wouldn't understand what she meant to me and what she meant to my family. And so even though I had to come up with verses in Greek, which was very difficult for me, I decided to do that. And I remember telling myself as I was reading those out in the church during her funeral, I'm not going to cry because I'm going to ruin the performance. It's not going to come through. The meaning and the emotion of these words is not going to come through if I start crying and not saying them properly. And so I did my best to do a good job performing that aspect of the funeral. So, yeah, that part was important for me.
I really like that you brought up that idea of not crying during those lamentations, because I definitely dealt with that. So the sort of, I guess, history, and I mentioned this in the essay, but having to sing Amazing Grace at all of these different funerals, that sort of came about because I used to sing in the church choir, and my aunt and uncle, and this is when I was in high school and college, and my aunt and uncle were planning on coming, and my uncle couldn't make it for one reason or another. And my aunt showed up, and my uncle was sad. He was very sad that he had missed this. And then he ended up dying a couple months later. And so my aunt was like, "He never got to hear you sing. I want you to sing that at his funeral." And so it sort of became this thing in our family that I sang it at every funeral. And I was a wreck during my cousin's funeral. And to the point where my mom was like, "Are you all right?" And I just remember thinking, "No, like, obviously I'm not okay. This is awful. This whole experience is awful." And then when it came time for me to sing the song, I shut that off, went up to the cantor microphone, sang the song, got through it, and then came back and broke down again. And so, you know, just sort of that conscious decision to stop that expression of that. So I appreciate Calliope that you shared that, because I definitely had a very similar experience. But in terms of performance in general, initially I was resistant to it. I can't remember if performance theory was suggested to me or if it was something that I came across in my literature review. But initially I was like, that doesn't really appeal to me. And then when I got into the field and started observing people, I realized right away how much it aligns with performance theory. So Schechner in particular talks about sort of the stages of performance, and he compares the performance of a play to the performance of any ritual. So he talks about sort of the warm-up stage, the practice, the sort of run through, the backstage area, front stage area, direction, all of this stuff. And I saw all of that. The moment that it sort of clicked for me was I was watching two of the funeral directors that I was observing break down. They had just had a funeral and they were putting everything away. They were cleaning things up, taking down chairs, moving flower pedestals out of the way, all of this stuff. And it occurred to me, they're breaking down a set. And so I realized that yes, there are so many parallels between, the performance of a play and this, the performance of this particular ritual. So that's when I really started to delve into performance theory, and I saw it everywhere. I had those processes of my own when preparing to sing the song, because even though it's a common song and we all know it, I definitely wanted to practice it beforehand. And, you have to practice it with the particular sound system, because everything, is different depending on where you're at. And so it just became like the ritual. It became something that I saw everywhere. I saw sort of connections to performance theory everywhere. Performance of the mourners, seeing who was a supporter, who was a chief mourner. So at my uncle's funeral, my aunt was so devastated that her daughter and son basically had to carry her everywhere. They each stood by her, holding on to an arm on each side, and just sort of moved her around the funeral, talking to various people. And so that role of support, her as the chief mourner, remembering things like the Knights of Columbus, changing of the guard thing that they did during my grandfather's funeral, sort of seeing all of these performative aspects, just various roles that people were expected to play during each of these ceremonies. So it was something that I couldn't ignore. It wasn't something that I could say, well, I'm not going to focus on that. It was just so central to everything I was observing that I had to talk about it.
And perhaps unsurprisingly, another theme that sort of runs throughout the book is empathy, right? Empathy with interlocutors, empathy with the dying, empathy with those who have lost loved ones, etc. Could you maybe talk about empathy as well as it stems from chapter to chapter?
We talked about this a little bit yesterday, Calliope and I, when we got together to kind of prepare for this. And that was, I think it's interesting that you pulled that out, because that wasn't intentional. We weren't necessarily going for empathy as a theme, but I think when you have a reflexive aspect, it's difficult not to have that, because recognizing that we are also mourners or potential mourners at the very least, it's hard not to make those connections when we're talking to other people who are going through grief or who are dealing with bereavement or loss or whatever it might be. So it was difficult. I think it wasn't intentional, but I think there's no way that it wouldn't come out in a reflexive study of death and dying.
Yes, all our contributors did empathize with someone who had lost or someone they themselves had lost. And so that did come through in every chapter. But yes, we did not notice that when we were putting this together.
This book is so valuable. I mentioned it before we started recording. I mean, it's supremely readable and touches on such a serious topic with so much care and so much attention. I can only say good things, you know? It's such a spectacular book.
Thank you so much.
There is a final question, which is a tradition on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
I am going to start working on, I wanted to study cultural change on the island of Karpathos. I've seen a lot of differences since I first started going there, and a lot more commodification of the land, and also things that were done, you know, services that were provided by family members have now become pay services you have to pay for, including, you know, not having some people not having family members around to lift the casket and take it, the coffin, and take it to its final resting place. And so having to pay for that, those kinds of services. So I wanted to look at those kinds of questions more broadly and kind of see what's happening, because I have noticed a lot of changes that have been occurring, and those interest me, and also kind of figuring out why it's happening and how it's impacting ideas of community and identity on the island of Karpathos. So that's kind of where I'm going with my next research project.
Yeah, and for me, as you mentioned at the beginning, as is mentioned in my little bio on the back of the book, I'm interested in fat studies and food studies, and particularly where those intersect. And of course, one of the reasons I became an academic is because I just love learning new things. And I think that's one of the best parts about being an anthropologist in particular, is that culture is always changing. So you're always learning new things. And so I really enjoy the opportunity to be able to do that. But the downside of academia, of course, is that you focus on one thing, right? So I spent so many years researching death and dying and bereavement and all that. And so I'm still kind of in the early stages of researching those things, basically learning about them in the first place, you know, in more detail, other than, you know, having a colleague who did fat studies and another colleague that did food studies, and kind of, you know, having personal connections to both of those things. And so I'm sort of still in the research phase of that. But I am starting to get to share it a little bit. So for example, one of the more recent classes that I taught at Wittenberg was globalization and food. And so we sort of, you know, I got to read the book along with them, you know, the food studies reader, and learn about the different ways that sort of different scholars, because food studies is interdisciplinary, which is near and dear to my heart as an American studies scholar. And, you know, sort of getting to see all of these different ways that different scholars talk about food and food processes and, you know, cultural connections to food and all that. It was kind of fun. The sort of final project, the term project, was a class cookbook, and I had them compile recipes and basically focus on one ingredient and then talk about the history of, or the journey of, that particular ingredient. So whether that's, for example, farm to table, or if it's, you know, maybe the social history of a particular ingredient. And so it was kind of cool to get to see those presentations. You know, just basically just reading everything that I possibly can to be able to start to learn about those studies and kind of figure out where I want to go. I did also, it was a short little blog type of post for HNET, which is a humanities listserv type of website, and they did a call for short essays, and I started writing. I wrote about profane and sacred food in that particular context, and the connection to fat studies was, I wrote specifically about a Weight Watchers recipe that I had grown up with. My mother, like many women in the United States, did lots of dieting, particularly in the 80s. With Weight Watchers, you know, it was sort of when Weight Watchers kind of took off, and this was a family favorite. recipes. So there's that connection to fat studies in the sense of, you know, sort of this fear of getting fat or being fat. So that the type of recipe that was chosen, but then also the connections of sacred and profane. So making sure that certain ingredients aren't in it, because those ingredients might either lead to high cholesterol or high blood pressure or weight gain or whatever. And then also, you know, sort of what was sacred in the sense that the recipe itself is stained. It's been used a lot, right? So there's notes in the margins and stains from whatever ingredients. And so it sort of became a sacred recipe in the sense that it was something that would please her children, her young children, who were, you know, picky to one degree or another, and then also something that could fit into her diet plan at the time. So that is something that I kind of want to continue to explore, is that this notion of sacred and profane when it comes to ingredients or types of foods or whatever, and how that connects to the ways that we pathologize fatness.
And once these projects turn into books, I'd love to have you back on the show.
Great. That would be wonderful. Thank you.
The book is Beyond the Veil, published in 2021 with Berghahn. Dr. Tama, Dr. Krista Dulaki, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having us. This was really great.
Thank you very much.